Welcome to episode 6 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is Dr. David Arsenault, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. For the past year, starting now his second year, he's actually served as the Rossetti Fellow for Future Conflict in the Institute for Future Conflict at the Academy, Air Force Academy, that is, here. David earned his PhD at Syracuse University and then later served as a pre-doctoral fellow both at Johns Hopkins University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. Followed that with a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard before coming here to teach at UCCS. His research, as you'll hear about here in a few moments, has focused on nuclear strategy, operations, and in particular how this all builds towards strategic stability, a concept I'm sure he'll explain in his comments. Now, as we get started here with all episodes, the opinions and ideas of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity, and should not be construed to do so. So with that as the traditional introduction, welcome, David.
Hey, Darren. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
And I want to point out one thing as a mea culpa on my end. This should have technically been episode 2, but we had some technical glitches as I was learning the software here, so this has been delayed. And part of that was I wanted to make sure early on we represented a variety of schools that are part of the partnership here and not just exclusively Air Force Academy folks. And in the meantime, you've moved over and you've been working at the Academy, but I want to point out that David is a faculty member at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, which is one of the founding three members of this partnership, along with the University of Colorado Boulder, and I have some faculty members up there lined up for future episodes. He also has played a very important role, which will tie in here to the first part of this conversation, in bringing undergraduate students to some of the events we have, like our fall and spring conferences, and getting them interested in applying their skills and abilities to the study of national security. So that sort of growing in the next generation of academics who are interested either in going into further academic study or maybe in the public service is very much something that I think the partnership is hoping to accomplish here in Colorado. So thank you for those contributions. And I think you've got at least a couple of your students are now looking at going off and starting their careers post-graduation in national security studies. So with that as a lead-in, let's talk a little bit about yourself. What got you into studying national security as a professional topic, and nuclear weapons in particular?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's not like most high school kids come out saying, you know, I want to be the next expert on nuclear strategy. So I think for myself and possibly a lot of my colleagues in the discipline, it's kind of a story of accident and chance. So I graduated with my undergraduate degree at the time thinking I wanted to be maybe working in the government, in the intelligence community, something like that. Just having kind of this national security interest underpinning me at the moment. But I graduated with my undergraduate degree into the Great Recession, which was not a particularly great moment to be trying to start a career of any sort. No one was hiring. There were no jobs to get in this domain. And I certainly wasn't going to be competing with folks who had deployments and military experience. You get the point preference for those types of jobs. So I said, okay, I'll go to grad school. Did okay as an undergrad. I can probably do okay as a grad student. Went to the Bush School at Texas A&M and was still on the track to kind of focus on intelligence and maybe defense analysis in general, but just staying in that kind of government service mindset. And I got that degree in 2012, which was sequestration, which for those of us trying to get government jobs, when there are no government jobs to get, that was also not a great moment. So after some deep internal reflection, trying to figure out what that actually meant for me, what should I do? I'd always been interested in teaching. I'd kind of worked my way through college, tutoring math and teaching guitar. So I enjoyed the teaching thing. And while at the Bush School, I developed a real interest in the topic. There's a professor there, Jason Castillo, teaches a course he calls Deterrence and Coercion, all about strategic deterrence with a heavy emphasis on nuclear. So, okay, well, maybe I'll just go wait this out, get a PhD in the process, and that'll keep the teaching door open. And when I got into my PhD program, I showed up at Syracuse University and talking with my advisor. And of course, the first question you have to answer is, okay, what do you want to study? And the extent of my answer was nuclear stuff, not particularly well formulated, but through good luck and having good mentorship, I was able to find some components of the research program that interested me more than others. So I got really heavy into the nuclear strategy and operations field, and just got really fortunate that along the way I had folks who were able to point me in the direction to get these good fellowship programs, good training and experiences along the way, and ended up in this world where it's a small community. So I really like that once you know one, you pretty much know them all, and been really lucky to get here through that kind of indirect and circuitous route.
Oh, thank you. As you point out, you have to break into a community and get to know people, and then it becomes easier to do this sort of thing because you got a natural well of support, and people then, you know, help lead you on to other things. So I think you're very much in the mode of being able to pay that back now with the support you're giving students. So that's all very good, and glad to see that. The topic mentioned earlier in sort of previewing your research included this topic of strategic stability. So maybe we ought to start there, because that's probably a concept that sounds interesting, but most people don't know, as a professional term of art, what that really implies. And in a world that for many people might have seemed to be somewhat stable up until a few years ago, we're now very unstable. So how would you define strategic stability, and how would you say our overall level of stability is, you know, perhaps keeping this focused in the nuclear realm rather than getting too far afield. What would you say you would explain the concept of strategic stability as best represented by?
Sure. So like any good concept in the field of political science, no one fully agrees on how we should talk about strategic stability. But I've got my favorite, so I'm going to assert it as authoritative here and just move forward with it. I think of strategic stability as the ability of states to interact during crises without escalating those diplomatic and conventional military disputes to the use of nuclear weapons. And that kind of keeps it focused, like you were saying, on the nuclear dimensions of strategic stability. So how do we basically have disputes without going nuclear is the short version of that. And if you look out into the world and say, well, how are we doing? I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, I think there are concerns at the moment about reports that China is going to, at a minimum, triple, upwards of quintuple the size of its nuclear arsenal. But for reasons I suspect will come up later, I think we can make a case that it really isn't that problematic for strategic stability. It's maybe concerning and scary and changes the strategic balance in terms of relative power. But I don't think it necessarily means that, oh, well, they have more, therefore escalation is more likely to occur. Versus when we look at scenarios like Russia's war in Ukraine, where basically since day one, somebody's been making a fairly overt nuclear threat, occasionally thinly veiled, but increasingly overt nuclear threats. And this is what makes the problem hard. If you go read the commentary and opinion pieces on this, you'll find folks divided into at least two camps, and I'll stick with the two stylized camps here. One is, well, they've been saying they would do it for so long now, and they haven't actually carried through, they being Russia, that it's all bluff and bluster. They would never actually go nuclear because they're not crazy. There's the other camp that says, well, maybe they would. And what if they really do care about things like retaining possession of Crimea more than we think they should? And we might say it's a ridiculous notion, but to Russian political leaders and Putin in particular, maybe that is kind of a red line. I fall kind of probably closer personally to that second camp. And most of my work focuses on kind of pathways to inadvertent escalation and looking for ways that we can accept the argument to that first camp, which says it would be foolish and crazy to use nuclear weapons on purpose, while supplementing that insight and saying, yes, but there are conditions under which things can get out of hand and just go wrong. And whether unintentional or unauthorized, we might end up seeing nuclear weapons come into play under certain circumstances. So I think in the easy one, but I think the most compelling case of strategic stability having some challenges is Russia's war in Ukraine. And then there's always the question in my mind of North Korea's ongoing nuclear modernization. They are trying to develop longer-range ballistic missiles that can reach the entirety of the United States, which they've at least proven in concept for years now. 2017, the test of the Hwasong 14 and 15 missiles. But they're improving that capability. They're working on their reentry vehicles to make sure that things don't just burn up as they come back into the atmosphere. Working on different fueling technologies that make them able to fire faster. And, you know, it's not like the United States and North Korea have avoided crises in the past. So I suspect those are always an option in the future. And it's maybe not at the time we're recording this podcast, it may not be at the top of the list, but I think it's one we should always be paying attention to as a potential flashpoint to challenge strategic stability.
Let me follow up on a couple of things your comments maybe ponder here. And let's see if I can get this into a decent form of a question. Because one of the things that we might assume incorrectly is that an authoritarian regime, we'll put these hostile countries mostly in an authoritarian camp, but that's a broad brush, but we'll say they're authoritarian, ought to have a tighter grip. We would presume have a tighter grip on command and control, particularly for the use of nuclear weapons. But might it be also possible that given that they are authoritarian regimes and have to keep control of the population, that the way they speak about nuclear weapons, we might even say the way they bluster about nuclear weapons, is not simply directed externally at us to have the effect of maintaining the relationship with us and to deter us where appropriate. But they're speaking to their own populations about their own country's strength. And it might be possible that in a very authoritarian state, let's take North Korea as being the poster child for that, which has a smaller number of nuclear weapons than any of the other powers you've mentioned so far, that it might be the most susceptible to pressures to escalate to these nuclear weapons to either protect the regime or to demonstrate the value of those weapons, that the power they give to the regime and the prestige they presume it holds in international relations, that I guess is the question, does that make matters worse? The more authoritarian the regime and the smaller the arsenal that they have for a variety of reasons. When, again, the assumption, if you're just thinking about this, is, well, they ought to have complete control because no one's going to use a weapon without the leader's command. I'm not saying that that would necessarily have a nuclear coup here, but that there just might be internal pressures we don't understand because it's a system so foreign from our own. Did I make sense of that? Can you see what I'm going for?
For sure. I think I'm going to answer in kind of two parts here. And the first response is going to be a very general response to your line of thinking. And then I'll narrow in and kind of connect it to this specific point you're making about who controls and makes decisions. So the general point is very straightforward and simply to agree with you. I think that we often understate the domestic roles of nuclear weapons. If you look at India's 1998 test, so they had tested a nuclear device in 1974, called it a peaceful nuclear explosion. In 1998, as part of the campaign trail, the BJP, kind of the India's right-wing political party, campaigned on this national security strength, etc. And very shortly after winning the election, went on to fulfill their promises and show how serious they were on the national security front by overtly testing nuclear weapons, which immediately prompted Pakistan to follow suit. Neither country for a very long period of time, they could have both done this by easily the late 1980s, but they waited until this kind of domestic thing pushed it in that direction. So there's absolutely this domestic signaling that goes on. There's a reason that in these authoritarian countries that you're talking about, we see nuclear weapons put on trucks and driven around the streets in parades. It's to signal not only externally, because obviously the U.S. intelligence community I mean, it's basically a cottage industry to watch the North Korean military parades and try to estimate how big the missiles are, look at the size of the transporter erector launchers, the trucks from which they can launch the missiles, how much fuel they might carry, how big of a warhead, could it carry multiple warheads? So that's obviously there's an external signaling thing, but a lot of it is to say, look, we can defend ourselves and just get on that kind of, let's get the national prestige factor out of these weapons. So absolutely.
And I think on that point, we're recording this here beginning of August 2023, the Russians recently visited North Korea, and that's exactly what they did. They were parading around their most up-to-date nuclear weapons. So that signaling, whether it's for us, for the Russians, for the domestic population, yeah, you're absolutely, that's very contemporary. That just happened within the last few weeks.
No, absolutely. It's always ongoing. And a trivial piece of information that really has nothing to do with the point here, but just bolsters my point about the cottage industry. There was a really interesting insight that during Russia's visit, they printed out, as you might expect, the posters summarizing the nuclear weapons and the military capabilities so that as the defense minister from Russia would approach, he would kind of know what he was seeing. And those posters were printed in Korean and English, not Russian, which I'm sure there's some logic they can come up with for why, but that's the level of detail that people are paying attention to these things, which I'm very grateful that those people are out there because they're answering some really technical questions about capabilities and just finding these little quirky things along the way that make my job much easier.
Interesting.
So the second half of my response to your question about kind of this authoritarian regime and who's in control. I think that the general thrust of your argument that in an authoritarian regime, we are more likely to see kind of political leaders heavily centralizing their control over nuclear weapons and the command part, the authority to use them. The finding that I basically have in my work on nuclear command and control is that there's kind of this scary outcome, though, where you have a country, let's use North Korea just because it's coming up now, where they have severe domestic instability. The political leadership under the Kim regime wants to maintain that really tight control over all things nuclear. But at the same time, they face pressures from external threats. I mean, Kim not unreasonably fears that he might go the way of Muammar Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein if he gets on even more so on the wrong side of the United States. And having to be prepared to mobilize nuclear forces in response to those types of threats. And what that means is these two pressures are pushing in opposite directions. And what you end up seeing is during peacetime, when everything's fairly safe and stable, you have that good old-fashioned authoritarian control. You have political leaders overseeing, literally monitoring the nuclear assets themselves. And certainly they have administrative control over moving, preparing, using anything nuclear. But we have some evidence that in countries like Pakistan, Russia, and North Korea, they have these plans and methods in place to rapidly delegate that ability to use nuclear weapons down to lower level military commanders early in a crisis. So what that means is, let's say you have an ongoing military exercise with the United States and South Korea. And North Korea, perhaps not unreasonably, looks at that and says, that's sufficiently concerning that we want to show them, first, that we don't like it, and second, that if they get any wise ideas about coming for dear leader Kim, we can do something about it. And as a function of that, they release the warheads out of storage down to military operators. They put the warheads on missiles, fuel them, put them on the launch pads, and maybe it's all meant to be a signal. But the problem is now that you have those military commanders. Yes, they're supposed to wait for the authorization, most likely. But what if the United States and South Korea see all this and say, wow, they might really be getting ready to go for this. And they start doing something as simple as interrupting communications or cyber attacks, trying to just like temporarily put down those capabilities. Now those lower level operators have to make a decision. Do I use them or do I lose them? So I think we end up in this really interesting world where I'm not necessarily worried about authoritarian regimes per se. China falls nicely into this camp where they keep warheads removed from missiles, dispersed across long spaces, etc. But those countries, Pakistan, North Korea, Russia, that I listed, those authoritarian regimes that also have these kind of pressures pushing in the opposite direction, I think they found these interesting models that seem to satisfy both safety and security and reliability, but it comes at a potential cost back to the original concept we discussed of strategic stability, which might suffer during a crisis as it gets hot.
And this idea of distributing weapons in time of a crisis is not unique to the countries you talked about. That was a basic problem the U.S. experienced in the Cold War.
Absolutely.
When do we deploy weapons that were intended to offset Soviet conventional numerical superiority? When do we pull those out of bunkers and distribute them to short-range missile launchers, or even, in some cases, there was quite a number of nuclear artillery shells, right? So those had to be deployed to have some deterrent effect, which was our intent primarily. But if they were necessary for defense, authority had to be delegated for their release. And that was a very weighty decision. Usually we only played that out in exercises, right? It was conceptual. But we had to grapple with that. So regardless of your governmental structure behind that, any form of government faces that fundamental decision of when do you put these weapons out so they may be usable, because if they're in bunkers, they're not going to be usable for either for defense and deterrence. You know, if they can't be deployed easily, may not contribute to deterrence either, which might not be the instrument you want to achieve your version of strategic stability, right? If the end goal is really to not have them not used, the irony is they have to be usable.
No, that's exactly right. And I think you've hit on two really important points here that I hope listeners can pull out of that. First, the thing that makes deterrence work, for anybody who's read good old-fashioned Thomas Schelling, has this phrase that has remained influential. It's the threat that leaves something to chance. If you're not willing to actually destabilize a little bit and leave some fear in the adversary's mind, because if they know you won't actually use nuclear weapons, then they're not going to really worry about you using nuclear weapons. So, I mean, this point is spot on. When you talk about how do you make deterrence work, part of it is making the adversary think you might actually go through with this. The U.S. example in the Cold War is a serious one, where you had field grade officers that theoretically had the ability at times to use nuclear weapons under certain conditions. And I mean, that's really low level decision making given the consequences at stake. But it was necessary to convince the Soviet Union at the time that, hey, if you cross this line, there's a really good chance that this gets out of hand very quickly in a way that neither of us particularly want. The move is now yours. The other thing that I think you hit on that's really important here, and I do want to make sure listeners kind of get a handle on, is that every country, no matter how democratic or authoritarian, faces the same exact dilemma when they're trying to figure out how to manage their nuclear forces. And we refer to this as the always-never dilemma. And the short version of this is that every country with nuclear weapons has to contend with two competing pressures. On the one hand, you want to make sure that nuclear weapons always launch when ordered. And that ties into the point we just discussed, where if you need them to go, you want to make sure that they are operationally capable of going. But at the same time, you want to make sure that nuclear weapons are never used unless authorized. You want to make sure that, yes, you've enabled your military to do what it needs to deter, but you don't want a Dr. Strangelove episode where somebody just gets it in their mind that they need to go use nuclear weapons first. And that's kind of the you know, crazy operator version of this, but it could be more closely related to what I was describing earlier with North Korea receiving cyber targeting of their nuclear assets. And at that point, if military operators have control, they might say, hey, I can't wait to find out more, I'm going. And even if political leadership did not want that to happen, they can. So every country has to figure out how they resolve the always never dilemma. And they come to different approaches, different solutions to that problem, but you can't escape it. You can try to balance in the aggregate, you can try to balance things out, but any individual decision you make necessarily prioritizes one over the other. The easiest example I can use is technological controls or technical controls like permissive action links, which basically means you have to type in some alphanumeric code to remove this thing that prevents the nuclear weapon from actually going boom. So that's good. It promotes the never side of the always never dilemma because it's more safe, it's more secure, it's less likely that someone can use nuclear weapons when they shouldn't. But that individual move necessarily comes at the expense of always, because now it will take you more time to relay the message to remove the permissive action link. It takes time to authenticate the order, and that gives the adversary time. If they go first, maybe they can beat you to the punch and your weapons won't respond. So you iterate that over every decision that goes into nuclear command and control. And yes, it adds up to something bigger, but there's no shortcut to get around it, is the short version.
Interesting. Yeah, the permissive action link technology is the one sort of nuclear technology I think we would willingly want to share with just about everybody to make sure they at least have that. Irony is, of course, involved in sharing nuclear technology, which is generally prohibited across the board. But you mentioned before, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I want to just so people kind of have some interesting insight on this. The United States did talk for a long time about trying to share permissive action link technology because it sounds great. And the United States tried sharing with two different partners. Oh, like this is definitely open source. We all kind of know this happened. One is the United States tried to share with Pakistan for fears of kind of domestic extremism, fears that some nuclear weapons might get out of hand and this would just be safe and secure and just nice for stability in South Asia. And Pakistan said, no thanks. We don't trust you to develop a permissive action link. We're not going to share warhead designs with you and weapons designs with you. And we don't believe that you'll give us something that when we try to actually remove them, we think that you're doing something to render the weapons inert, basically. So, okay, maybe that kind of makes sense. The United States and Pakistan have a long, troubled history. But then you say, okay, well, what's an easy test of this? The United States tried to share permissive action links with the United Kingdom, and it would be really hard for me to think of a country with whom the United States gets along better on these kind of geostrategic issues. And the United Kingdom just basically said, no thanks, we're good. They have a system that they believe works well, and they purely rely on the professionalism of their military operators. And the system has worked very well for them. This is not saying they made a right or wrong decision. It's simply saying, I think the United States policymaking community did kind of play with this idea of sharing the technology for a long time. And even with friends, we had a hard time moving that forward. So yeah, it's kind of on our short list of, if I could make something happen, it'd be great. But there are real limitations on getting the other side to play along in that domain.
Because it's a question of trust. You know, we could go on. A lot of these issues are very interesting. And we've already had a good conversation here. I want to ask maybe one more question, offer up an area for some questions and see how you respond. Because one topic you mentioned before, which I think is important to reiterate here, is the danger of use or lose. And it's one thing when we had the U.S.-Soviet confrontation where we primarily thought of missiles in the home countries, thousands of miles away from each other, flight times of half an hour or whatever, with generally understood to be satellite warning, radar warning of incoming attacks and such, or submarines and things. When you have weapons that are closer to the actual battle area, a conventional battle area, there is the danger, and some of the confrontations you mentioned, whether it's the U.S. and North and South Korea versus North Korea, or India versus Pakistan, or now with the Russians engaged in Ukraine, you have the potential for nuclear weapons in range of attack by conventional forces, which might confuse the matter, right? Are you actually being deliberately targeted? Is it interesting? What would you say, and this is speculative here, we're going to move into just speculative questions and we'll wrap up with a traditional future-oriented question here in a minute, but is there some wisdom, and I don't want to say many positive things about the current Russian regime, but I've noted through open source that they have alleged to have deployed nuclear weapons into Belarus, which is not really a party to the conflict in the same way the Russian territory is. And the Ukrainians have not been striking Belarusian territory, if I'm correct. So have they addressed this problem in a sneaky way by putting nuclear weapons, which present a threat, in a piece of territory which is not likely to present the same use-or-lose conundrum? And yet they hold the sword over the Ukrainians' head in perhaps a very dastardly way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a mixed bag again here, where I believe that is exactly what Russia was hoping to get, something that comes across as more than just the verbal bluster that we've seen since their full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But by virtue of the fact that the nuclear weapons are not really in the way, back to the point we discussed a little bit earlier, it's not really as serious of a signal where you're saying, hey, if you overrun our positions, you're also overrunning our tactical nuclear weapons capability, and those are pretty much designed to prevent being overrun by conventional forces. So it actually looks like Russia has been reticent to engage in that severe of a degree of brinkmanship where they actually put the nuclear weapons in the way. And if you think about what does moving nuclear weapons into Belarus do for Russia? I mean, my short answer is really nothing. It is a signal. So it's not nothing. Maybe I'm overstating the claim here. Operationally, in terms of battlefield outcomes, though, I mean, Ukraine does not have nuclear weapons, and it is not officially a NATO country. And I know there are some debates over, well, if Russia used nuclear weapons against Ukraine, maybe some fallout would land in NATO countries. Would that be enough to trigger Article 5 commitments and make NATO come to the defense of Ukraine in that scenario? I think you'll get answers on both sides there, but I think you'll find a lot of people who look at that and say, I don't want to go fight Russia now that they've shown they're willing to use nuclear weapons. I mean, I think that's a really high escalation threshold that would give a lot of U.S. policymakers pause, and we would see a huge debate. Were they to put those same nuclear weapons in the way, I think it's a more severe signal. But because they're kind of out of the way, it's like it's posturing in a sense, but Ukraine's not nuclear and it can't respond with nuclear weapons. Russia could launch those nuclear weapons from kind of wherever they want and generate the same types of effects, just given that they are not really in the fray for conventional conflict. To your point, though, if we then see warheads being released and put on tactical nuclear weapons, and then those embedded within conventional units, that would be one of those clear signs of, oh boy, we should probably start worrying a little bit more now.
Yeah, so it's an interesting situation, just the complexity of the geography and what's going on. It's hard to really figure out what's in the mind of the adversary there. So I think we'll have to wrap that line of argument up, interesting though it is, because we could go on for another half an hour or so. And we might revisit this later on and focus on a specific topic in the future. And I know you've got a very robust research agenda, which has a lot of other interesting pieces out there and questions you're looking at. So maybe we'll come back to those in the future. But for the future, I'm going to ask you the question I've been posing to everybody thus far, which says, in the next 5 years, what change or trend in international relations, domestic politics, economics, law, technology, or culture do you think is going to have the greatest impact on national security? Again, just your opinion.
Sure. I mean, I can't imagine the number of answers somebody could provide to that, and it's necessarily forecasting, so you know, you get what you pay for here. I'll probably be wrong here. But at my core, I'm kind of a traditionalist. And what I mean by that is when we see things that are kind of bright and shiny, new technologies, for example, my first thought is trying to figure out how do those affect longstanding and enduring challenges in international relations. So I'll say that I worry about certain things, crisis initiation, crisis escalation, strategic stability. These are old concepts. There's nothing new about them, but what they look like and how you maintain safe relations with other countries, I do think can change over time depending on technological factors, et cetera. So I think, to use a boring answer, the fact that there are either rising or near peer or strategic, whatever your favorite adjective is, competitors to the United States is really my big concern, because that is the thing that opens the door for all of these other things like advanced technologies, et cetera, to come into play. So over the next, I'm using 5 years kind of as my window, because, you know, maybe some dramatic technological innovation occurs. But if it occurs in such a way that then enters a world in which you have major powers competing for influence and control over certain areas, which we did not see for about 20 years after the end of the Cold War. I mean, that moment of, you know, people sometimes refer to it as unipolarity. The United States was kind of the unquestioned superpower. And if you tried to push too hard on the United States, you saw what happened. The United States would show up and whack you with the military stick, and you'd say, oops, I made a mistake. And now we're seeing some sides being more willing to challenge that. But let me add just like one thing that I think is more specific, because that's a very general, oh, the international order is being challenged. Yes, we all have some sense of that. And I'll tie in some one dimension that I don't think is unilaterally the most important thing, but it is one that I've spent more time thinking about and worrying about. And it's the trend towards automation, basically. Yeah. So as you have technologies and we realize that humans are slow and deeply fallible, I worry about how automation ties into these enduring concepts. So now imagine a crisis scenario where usually you would have human analysts kind of slowly pouring through the data and trying to figure out what things mean. And if you can automate some stages of the analysis and it spits out something saying, hey, very high confidence, we expect the adversary is about to do, you know, they're about to do something really dangerous, potentially use nuclear weapons and maybe start a conventional attack. You are now creating shorter windows, time windows to make decisions. And during moments of crisis, short windows are bad because you have poor information, you have massive amounts of uncertainty, you have a lot of cognitive pressure to overcome. I mean, we've all tried to operate in moments of stress and it's usually not great. So you combine all of those things, and when automation just speeds that kind of stuff up, I do worry about the ways in which that will affect crisis escalation and even initiation, just getting things started. And once you get a crisis started, they can be kind of hard to unwind. So I'm not saying this is going to automatically be the end of the world, because I'm to some extent skeptical about certain forms of integration with automation, like into the nuclear command and control structures of countries, because they, I mean, if you have leaders who are unwilling to share use authorization with people they actually trust, I suspect they're unlikely to suddenly delegate that out to a computer that doesn't actually really listen to them. But there are other areas in which I can fully expect automation to have that kind of effect. And in this broader world that I've described of, you know, competition over influence, territory, institutions, etc., those kinds of emerging trends coupled with the broader trends, I think can be deeply problematic.
Well, you know, and the contribution of that automation to shaping perceptions of the crisis by those stressed human decision makers puts me in mind to think of two incidents separated by about 10 years. There was the 83-84 nuclear exercise that was misinterpreted by the Russians, and I believe it was a colonel that basically, you know, cut it off at a certain level and said, this is not what we're seeing. But that was human intervention against all the other indicators that was coming in that were suggesting, you know, war is in the offing. And then, again, about 10 years later, under the early days of the Russian Federation, there was an indicator that came in off of probably radar or something. It was a rocket fired out of Norway that presented to the system as though it were the nuclear attack. But again, you had a single individual basically said, I don't think so. And so if automation is given greater credibility, at least in the analysis or framing of what a crisis is, then even though it may not have fire control release authority, it's going to have an impact. So that's a good and perhaps disturbing thing to think about. But, you know, keeping the right human in the loop and providing them with I guess comes back to education. You know, they need to trust their judgment and have their judgment shaped appropriately over the years before they get into that position. So thank you for that, I guess. So it's good to think about. You know, may not be hopeful. This, but I mean, if we think about it, you know, maybe we can prevent that from going too far.
For sure. And the only good news I can throw out there is I am not the first person to think of this. There are institutions and groups that are putting thought into this. I know UNID, or the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research, held an event in which I participated a little while ago, talking about what are the roles of artificial intelligence, et cetera, in these types of procedures, and how can we get countries on the same page? Ideally, that sounds great. Getting it in practice will obviously be difficult, but, you know, just to end on some version of an optimistic note, I think, you know, there are smart people working on the problem right now, and we're at least working on that problem before it is present. Hopefully those two things line up to where we get some control over it in time.
Well, that's a good note to end on, I think. So thank you, David, for taking time to discuss all these issues and concepts of strategic stability in particular. And thank you all that have been listening to this sixth episode of the N3SP podcast. Hope you've enjoyed hearing about this set of topics, which again comes back to nuclear issues and research that's being done here, both by faculty who are part of the Academy and University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, and bringing new students into the mix for creating a future generation, which is one thing we didn't talk about perhaps as much as I thought we might, but we can come back to that. So for all of you who have tuned in, thank you. Stand by for future episodes. And in the meantime, if you'd like more information about the partnership and its events, please go to our website at n3sp.org. Goodbye.